I'm Todd Hatton, and this is I Am John Scopes. Think of a law you don't like. Well, more than don't like. It offends you on every level. It's wrong. It's bad. The works. Now, a group of people asks you, hey, would you be willing to be the defendant in a court case testing this law? Before you answer, a warning. Doing this will make you the most notorious person in America, and your privacy, gone. The media will be on you all the time. And think about this. Saying yes means you'll be forever linked with this case and its issues. Some will call you a hero. Others will say you're the devil himself. Would you still do it? In 1925, a young high school teacher from Western Kentucky faced that very choice, and he said yes. But why?
Then to Dayton came a man with his new ideas so grand, and he said we came from monkeys long ago. But in teaching his belief, Mr. Scopes found only grief, for they would not let their old religion go.
Here in the 21st century, evolution is settled science. It's a thing. Evolution in society and culture, well, that's complicated. And we're still arguing about it. And when we do, one name keeps popping up.
Scopes Monkey Trial.
John Scopes.
1925 Scopes Monkey Trial.
The Scopes Trial.
Officially, it's the state of Tennessee versus John Thomas Scopes. All across the U.S. and around the world, it was portrayed as the epic clash between the theory of evolution and the Book of Genesis. Something that, before that hot summer of 1925, only scientists and theologians argued about, and then mostly amongst themselves. The monkey trial took that debate viral. And all because of a state law that said you couldn't teach human evolution, a law that the governor who signed it didn't think anybody would enforce. And one young man, oddly enough, the one player in the monkey trial most people know the least about. And the trial's named for him. So let's fix that. Who was John Scopes? Now, getting the answers is going to require some travel. One of the people best qualified to help is retired Texarkana journalist and author Dr. James Presley. He and Scopes were good friends, and they collaborated on John's 1967 autobiography, Center of the Storm. And after a flurry of phone calls and emails, we made arrangements to get together. So I loaded up the car and headed for Texas. It's a long trip, so let's get some facts while we're on the way. Straight from the horse's mouth, or in this case, his book, Center of the Storm.
I was born, a child of this strange century, on August 3rd, 1900, in Paducah, Kentucky, an Ohio river town that was a symbol of the live and let live philosophy that I was taught at home. A town Mark Twain would have loved.
He was the youngest of five children and the only son of Thomas and Mary Alba Scopes. Thomas was born in the UK in 1860, and when he got here in 1885, he had four books among his few earthly possessions. A Bible, a hymn book, a book about the French Revolution, and Charles Darwin's On the Origin of Species.
From the eastern United States, he wandered south to Galveston, Texas, to Mississippi and Tennessee. At Union City, Tennessee, Dad found an American windfall. He met and won a gentle, blue-eyed Kentucky belle, Miss Mary Alva Brown.
Her family hailed from Fulton County, Kentucky. Mary Alva was strong and level-headed. Later on, she told her son, a man can't be a success unless his wife helps him. His success is hers, too. He said his parents made a good team. Some 450 miles later, I arrived at Presley's house, an early 20th century Victorian, that's appropriately enough, in one of Texarkana, Texas's historic neighborhoods.
Well, I'm James Presley, and I'm native Texan, a country boy, and a big metropolis called Red Springs, in which there were no reds and very few springs.
And very few people. Presley got into college, the Air Force, then back into college for a PhD in history.
In between, I did a lot of newspapering. I started out in Texarkana, where I grew up in this area. And then newspapered later, after I got out of the Air Force, in Shreveport, Louisiana, Shreveport Times, which is where I met John Scopes.
And sitting at his dining room table, Presley told me just how that happened. One Friday night in 1959, working late at the Times, he got a phone call from a colleague.
I was planning to drive from Shreveport to Texarkana to visit my parents for the weekend. And Patsy Farmer, who was another reporter and a feature writer at the Shreveport Times, invited me to a party at her apartment that night. There were going to be a lot of people there. And I said, well, I'm sorry, but I'm going to Texarkana, and as soon as I get off work at 11 p.m. She said John Scopes was going to be there. Now, she had every year around the time of the Dayton trial, she would interview John Scopes. And she put out the bait there, how could I resist? I said, well, I think I'll try to make it. So I got off at 11 o'clock, and I went to the party. I said, is John Scopes here? No, he's been delayed. He's on his way, though. So around midnight, he shows up. So, of course, I buttonholed him as soon as I could, and we started talking.
That led to correspondence, which in turn led to John recommending a good Shreveport allergist to Presley, and finally to them meeting up for lunch. They had common interests, like the environment and natural foods, and so they got to be good friends. I asked Presley what John said about his parents.
The way he presented it to me, they were both, they really were good mates because she supported, they had common goals, and she supported his father, whatever he did, so he could do his own thing. But his father was a great influence, and from the earliest day, he'd read to him some of the classics of English literature. And even though he, you know, probably got into the usual boys' scrapes around that time, the early part of the 20th century, still he had this influence right at home.
That influence went beyond books. Thomas believed that what you did with what you learned was just as important.
He felt that a man should make his own world. He believed that each individual's position in society should correspond to his ability and social attainments, regardless of race, religion, sex, creed, or color. Don't depend upon what your ancestors have done, he would tell me. You take care of today, and the past will take care of itself. And the future, too.
Thomas was also very careful to put his morality where his mouth was. In the 1910s, he was an elder at a Cumberland Presbyterian church in Paducah. His colleagues had decided to rid the River City of its prostitute population. Thomas was shocked and angered by their holier-than-thou attitude, and he told them so. Then he left the church, never to return. And what did John learn from his dad? One, keep your head screwed on straight.
As we go back even to the year of the trial, he didn't let it go to his head. You know, he turned down no telling how much money. And his father appreciated that. He would have gone along with whatever his son decided to do, but he's very pleased. They turned down this get-rich scheme.
And two, nothing beats a generous spirit. Presley has this story about a trip John Scopes took in 1967. He was slated to do the Today Show, a promotion for Center of the Storm, the book they had collaborated on. By then, John was not in the best of health, and he wasn't looking forward to the trip. But he was going anyway, and the reason he gave still moves Presley to this very day.
I said, well, you know, we can dispense with it. I'll tell the agent, our agent, Blanche Gregory, that, you know, you're just not up to it. He said, no, it's important. To help you get a good start. And I didn't think much of that, but later, Maureen McManus, who did the publicity for Holt, told me that she went with him to join him. He was about to go on, I think, a TV interview or something like that. And she said something, appreciated you doing this. And he said something, I wouldn't be doing it, but he said, I wanted to do it to help Jim.
Of all the anecdotes about John Scopes, this one is perhaps the most powerful and illustrative. It seems there were very few lengths John wouldn't go to for something, or in this case, someone he believed in. And if that sounds like a stretch, here's Scopes himself on a Canadian television show in 1965.
You taught the theory of evolution, but did you personally believe it, what you were teaching?
Well, sure, if I'd taught it, I'd believed it.
Well, not everybody does.
Well, also, I would have taught it had I not believed it.
Thanks to his father, John had been exposed early on to Darwin's work. and it's very possible that he had been exposed to the other side of the debate just as early. In June of 1909, the Chautauqua came to the old Wallace Park in Paducah, just a short walk from the Scopes home on Burger Road. Over 3,000 people were there to picnic, play games, and listen to the touring lectures and performers. The big draw, the featured speaker, was one of America's great orators. When he took the platform, over 6,000 ears heard him warn of what he believed to be an emerging moral threat, evolution.
The Darwinian theory represents man as reaching his present perfection by the law of hate, the merciless law by which the strong crowd out and kill off the weak. I prefer to believe that love, rather than hatred, is the law of development. How can hatred be the law of development when nations have advanced in proportion as they have departed from that law and adopted the law of love? William Jennings Bryan.
There's no way to know if the Scopeses were there that day. It's possible. Bryan was an early champion of the progressive movement, campaigning for child labor laws and women's suffrage. Thomas Scopes was a progressive himself. He'd been involved in organized labor for years. So 8-year-old John could have been there, getting a sneak peek at his future. But all that would have to wait. In 1913, work moved the Scopeses to Danville, Illinois, and then to Salem in 1915.
There in the new, strange Yankee North, I observed racial integration in the schools for the first time. My sister Leela and I were the only Scopeses in school, also the only Southerners, which apparently made us novelties.
And targets, apparently. At assemblies, John and his sister were seated, out of the usual order, next to the only two African-American students. In Center of the Storm, Scopes writes that it was a sort of punishment by the Yankee school officials.
Those four seats in the egalitarian North taught me early in life that hypocrisy and prejudice have no Mason-Dixon line, but flourish in all locales in all seasons, and that the evils of self-righteousness, in its many guises, go endlessly on.
John graduated high school in Salem, spring 1919. He worked through the summer to pay for his first year of college, back when you could do that. That fall, John entered the University of Illinois at Urbana. His grades were good, but he worked so hard that at the end of the year, John got very sick, bronchitis. His professors gave him a pass on his exams and full credit for the year. Thinking he'd do better where it was warmer, Scopes transferred to the University of Kentucky. He was drawn to law and science, zoology from Dr. William Delbert Funkhauser, evolution from Arthur McQuiston Miller, nicknamed Monkey, and philosophy and logic from Glanville Sox Terrell. Sox, as in Socrates, by the way.
When I had reached the status of a senior, I suddenly discovered that because of my pleasant academic wanderings, I had 3 years of prerequisites, but no major and no minor. I had a year in which to finish work for a degree. My hardest year of college.
But he did it. John Scopes graduated from UK with a bachelor's in the spring of 1924. By then, Thomas had retired and moved the family one last time back home to Paducah. John headed there himself after graduation. And that summer, he got the job offer that changed everything. Ray County High School in Dayton, Tennessee needed someone to teach science and math and coach the football team, and they needed them fast. So fast that they picked a candidate from UK's Teacher Placement Bureau who'd played only basketball in high school.
Teaching seemed the best way to replenish my depleted financial resources. When I had saved enough money, I intended to return to the university for a law degree and perhaps settle down to the quiet life of an attorney. Near the end of summer, I was offered a coaching and teaching job, which would pay $150 a month for a contract extending from September 1st to May 1st. It was my best offer, and I accepted it.
And just like every other time, it seemed fate offered John Scopes the chance to be in the right place at the right time. He said yes. And when we return, we'll be in Dayton, Tennessee ourselves for a look at a certain trial and what it takes to step out of the spotlight on I Am John Scopes. This is I Am John Scopes. I'm Todd Hatton. On March 21, 1925, Tennessee Governor Austin P. signed House Bill 187, better known as the Butler Act, into law. He said he didn't think the statute would ever be enforced. The law says any teacher at any state-funded school convicted of teaching human evolution would be on the hook for a fine of not less than $100 and not more than $500. That's about $1,300 to $6,700 today. How did this happen? How did it become a crime to teach science in school? It all started in 1859 when Charles Darwin published On the Origin of Species. Basically, the theory of evolution is, well, I'll let a professional tell you about it.
There's really two aspects that should be taken into consideration when you're having this idea of the theory of evolution.
That's Dr. David Canning, associate professor and Houston Endowed Chair of Pre-Medicine at Murray State University.
The first aspect is that Darwin showed that evolution had occurred. If you look at his book, The Origin of Species, 1859, that it really presented a great deal of evidence that evolution had occurred and does explain this concept of a common ancestor to all animals and, by extension, plants. The second aspect of evolution, which Darwin didn't really totally tie up, was the theory of natural selection. And to this day, we are still debating, having a sort of like a work in progress as to actually what natural selection contributes to evolution, the mechanisms, and is there other things which contribute to this sort of like a biological phenomena of change over time in the morphology, physiology, and lifestyles of organisms.
It was controversial, but by Darwin's death in 1882, most scientists accepted evolution. The religious reaction was more complex. Most theologians opposed it, but only a few objected because they interpreted the Bible literally. They tended to rely on arguments from design, like the eye supposedly being too complex to have evolved. That would change. Edward Larson wrote the book on the Scopes trial, literally. Summer for the Gods won him a 1998 Pulitzer Prize, and for many years since then, he's visited Dayton for its annual John T. Scopes Festival. That's where we met up, and as we sat in the actual courtroom where the trial took place, I asked him what changed in religion between the 1870s and 1925.
In 1925, religion in America was dividing. It was a time of growing modernism within many mainline denominations. Now, modernism was a term of art back then. I guess we'd say liberalism today, but it involved a critical reading of the biblical text. It was still very Christ-focused.
Now, that did not wash with American fundamentalists.
Well, the term fundamentalist was actually coined in 1919 to refer to this conservative, literalistic reaction to the growth of modernism within the church, where you had dissenters from this view, the conservatives, clinging ever more tightly to a literal interpretation of the Bible. Many of the seminaries in America had flipped over to the modernist side, and in reaction, there was a return to a more literalistic reading of the Bible than had even occurred, or had certainly occurred, in evangelical Christianity during the 19th century. So you'll see a split in the church. You see that in many, playing out in many specific denominations. You see it in the Presbyterian denomination, in the Methodist denomination, where the denomination itself was being rent asunder between the so-called modernist and the so-called fundamentalist camps.
And one of the big names advocating fundamentalism? William Jennings Bryan. He was U.S. Secretary of State from 1913 until 1915, and he opposed American involvement in World War I. He was appalled by its large-scale industrial carnage. Bryan laid the blame squarely on science and Darwin. In the 1960 film Inherit the Wind, loosely based on the Dayton trial, the Bryan analog, Matthew Harrison Brady, sums up the great commoner's position quite nicely.
I have been to their cities, and I have seen the altars upon which they sacrifice the futures of their children to the gods of science. And what are their rewards? Confusion and self-destruction. New ways to kill each other in wars. I tell you, gentlemen, the way of scientism is the way of darkness.
And Bryan's solution? State laws banning the teaching of evolution.
And this was part of a national crusade led by William Jennings Bryan. These laws have been proposed throughout the country, and lesser restrictions had been passed by other states over the preceding two or three years. In fact, the bill fell only one vote short of passage in Kentucky just before this. The first actual passage of a complete bill banning the teaching of evolution was in Tennessee. And as soon as it happened, the American Civil Liberties Union, as part of its defense of academic freedom, offered to defend any school teacher willing to challenge the law in court.
A group of Dayton civic leaders, including school board chairman Fred Robinson and businessman George Rapelier, thought a trial like that might be good for Dayton. A little attention and hopefully a lot of business. Now they needed a defendant. The regular biology teacher won't do. He has a family. He's a pillar of the community. Oh, and he's the high school principal. Well, but one of the group has this bright idea. There's this one science teacher, a young guy. He's not local. A contract employee, and most everybody likes him. He'd be perfect. But would he do it? On a warm May afternoon, just after the end of the school term, the group asked John Scopes to stop by Robinson's drugstore. When he arrived, Rapelier told him they'd been arguing that no one could teach biology without teaching evolution. John agreed. The state textbook was George Hunter's A Civic Biology. In Center of the Storm, Scopes lays out what happened next.
I explained that I'd got the book out of stock and had used it for review purposes while filling in for the principal during his illness. I opened the book and showed them the evolutionary chart and the explanation of evolution. You can't teach biology without teaching evolution. This is the text, and it explains evolution. Then you've been violating the law, Robinson said.
Actually, well, maybe not. Dr. Larson explains.
To this day, no one knows if he ever taught evolution. The general understanding was he probably didn't. He was the part-time football coach, and he was the science teacher for the younger grades, but he did not teach biology, and in his regular courses, there would not have been any evolution taught.
Either way, if he'd taught evolution, then so had every other teacher in Tennessee. If it was in the book, then you taught it, and it was in the book, page 192 to be exact. So Fred Robinson asked John, would you be willing to stand for a test case? Scopes thought for a moment, and...
I realized that the best time to scotch the snake is when it starts to wiggle. The snake already had been wiggling a good long time. I said, if you can prove that I've taught evolution and that I can qualify as a defendant, then I'll be willing to stand trial.
And that was that. Robinson called the Chattanooga News to tell them they'd arrested Scopes for teaching evolution, and John finished his drink and went back to his tennis match. It was all very casual, but the monkey trial was on. Well, almost. The prosecution and defense teams were still coming together. The original local prosecutors were replaced by District Attorney Tom Stewart and William Jennings Bryan, who hadn't tried a case in 36 years. Clarence Darrow offered his services to the ACLU, free of charge, for the first and only time in his career. But the ACLU wanted nothing to do with him. Too radical, they said. A headline hunter. It'd be a circus. And with Darrow, they'd never get into federal court. But at a meeting in New York, they finally bothered to ask John what he thought.
I want Darrow, I said. We should expect a gouging roughhouse battle for which Darrow and Malone were best suited.
Now the monkey trial was on. Dr. Larson sets the scene.
Dayton was somewhat a dying town. Dayton was not an old town. It had developed with the coming of the railroads in the late 19th century and had grown up to about 3,000 people. There were coal operations nearby, and those had largely shut down by 1925. It was not a particularly rooted place. It was not a particularly religious place. It stood different from the power structure in Nashville, and so it was a place that was willing to take a chance on running a sensational test case of the state's and Bryan's new anti-evolution law.
Many in Dayton were convinced that chance would pay off, but not many outside Dayton were so sure. And legendary journalist H.L. Mencken of the Baltimore Sun was one of them. In a column filed from Dayton, he pondered,
will these refugees bring any money with them? Will they buy lots and build houses? Will they light the fires of the cold and silent blast furnace down the railroad tracks? On these points, I regret to report, optimism has to call in theology to aid it. Prayer can accomplish a lot. It can cure diabetes, find lost pocketbooks, and restrain husbands from beating their wives. But is prayer made any more efficacious by giving a circus first? Coming to this thought, Dayton begins to sweat.
Neither the expected thousands nor the economic boom appeared. Hundreds flocked to Dayton, not thousands, and mainly from the surrounding area. The trial did come through in one way. It got attention. Science fiction writer H.G. Wells was offered a spot in the defense team. He turned it down, though, not a lawyer. And get this, the Nobel laureate, chemist and physicist Marie Curie, even published a letter supporting Scopes. So what's John Scopes doing while all of this is going on? Ed Larson fills in the blanks while a maintenance team vacuums the old courtroom we're in.
After he was indicted, he spent the early part of the summer on a publicity and fundraising tour for the ACLU to raise funds for the trial, which took him to New York City, where he went to the American Museum of Natural History and met with Henry Fairfield Osborne, their famous director, where he went to Washington, D.C., where he gave talks, where he was feted at fundraising events among high society and those in various eastern cities. So that gave him an active role. He was interviewed frequently. He appeared in the press. So while he was not necessarily an instigator, he certainly was an active participant up through the trial.
And the trial had been billed in the media as a clash of titans. The agnostic Darrow versus the faithful Brian. Head to head, mano a mano, to the death. And it began Friday, July 10th. Darrow brought in scientists, ministers, and theologians to testify on evolution and its compatibility with religion. Darrow wanted to try the issue and not the defendant. He was ready to concede Scopes' guilt. In fact, a local account tells how he went out of his way to make sure Scopes was guilty. Because John wasn't sure he taught evolution, Darrow wasn't about to put him on the stand. But the prosecution had called a student, Howard Morgan, to testify. Darrow was staying at Morgan's house, and the day before young Howard was to take the stand, Darrow hired a cab, piled himself, Scopes, and Howard inside, and rode around town while John taught the boy about evolution. Now the boy wouldn't have to lie. Fortunately, prosecutors only asked Howard if Scopes taught evolution, not where. Darrow wanted to get the case out of the circuit court and all the way to the U.S. Supreme Court. But prosecutors had other ideas. They wanted the trial firmly focused on only one question. Did John Scopes violate the law? And Judge John Ralston was, either by chance or design, on the same page. Darrow's scientists and ministers excluded. All of them. That didn't leave Darrow with much. He couldn't even get his own Bible experts in the witness stand. That left him one choice and one possible Bible expert. 1960's Inherit the Wind offers this version of what happened when Darrow got Brian on the stand.
You believe that every word written in this book should be taken literally?
Everything in the Bible should be accepted exactly as it is given there.
Now, what about this part right here where it talks about Jonah being swallowed by the whale?
The Bible does not say a whale. It says a big fish.
As a matter of fact, it says a great fish. But I guess that's one's pretty much the same as the other. Now, what do you think about that business?
I believe in a God who can make a whale and who can make a man and make both do what he pleases.
This part of Inherit the Wind is actually pretty close to Brian and Darrow's confrontation, only it didn't happen in a courtroom. The July heat forced the proceedings outside onto a specially built platform. Almost everyone in town could come to see, except, thanks to Tom Stewart, the jury.
That first day, well, what do you think it was, 24 hours long?
Bible says it was a day.
Well, it was no sun. How do you know how long it was?
The Bible says it was a day.
Well, was it a normal day, a literal day, 24-hour day?
I don't know.
What do you think?
I do not think about things that I do not think about.
Do you ever think about things that you do think about?
The trial didn't last very long, 12 days. Last day, Tuesday, July 21st, the judge charged the jury and sent them out. 9 minutes later, guilty. Ralston asked about a fine. The jury foreman said he'd leave that up to the judge. No problem. $100, the minimum. Everybody made statements, including John, and then everybody went home. It was almost anticlimactic. After an intense 3 months, a lot of people, John Scopes included, were wondering what was next. But not William Jennings Bryan. He'd stayed in Dayton to give speeches. 5 days after the end of the trial, he died. He'd gone to church, had a big lunch, then took a nap, and he never woke up. Since before the trial, John Scopes had been getting mail from around the world, so much that at first it filled a room at the boarding house where John lived. Then so much more arrived that they had to move the pile onto the front porch. Now that the trial was over, John decided it had to go. A couple of friends helped him wrangle the mound into the yard.
Each of us struck a match and fired all sides of the, for the most part, unopened mail. Many newspaper stories reported that I had been offered all kinds of fortunes and movie contracts and God knows what else. Probably that was accurate. Any kind of offer in the world could have been among the mail we burned that day, and I wouldn't have known it. I neither knew nor cared. The best thing to do, I was beginning to realize, was to change my life and seek anonymity.
Back in 21st century Dayton, I asked Ed Larson where he thought this realization came from.
John Scopes was a private person, and after the trial, it was almost as if he was embarrassed by the fame and celebrity status, because he didn't think that he deserved it. He didn't like that role. When the trial ended, the expert witnesses and various people associated with the defense raised funds to give him a scholarship so he could go on with school. Originally, it was thought he'd go on to law school.
In Lexington, I changed my mind. Dean Charles Turk of the law school was anxious for me to enroll. He told me I could be another Clarence Darrow. Afterward, I realized that if Dean Turk saw in me another Darrow, so would others. Much as I admired Darrow, I didn't want to have to live up to his reputation or to anybody else's. This I wanted most of all, and I began to realize a life as an attorney would not allow it.
James Presley says after this realization, Scopes decided to go to Chicago to get a master's in geology. But it turns out that while you can take the defendant out of the monkey trial, it's really hard to take the monkey trial out of the defendant.
He said that so often when he's at the University of Chicago, he'd be called out, said, you have a visitor there, it'd be a reporter. Wanted to write another story about the Scopes trial. So this was something that wherever he went, in this country at least, it seemed he couldn't escape from it. But he went to South America, and so the time he got back, the furor had died down some. So he escaped it, but not fully.
John Scopes finally settled in Shreveport, Louisiana, and Ed Larson says John's wife Mildred, whom he'd married after Dayton, encouraged him to let the trial catch up, to get involved with his own legacy.
And so when Inherit the Wind was brought out in 1960, at his wife's urging, he agreed to do a bit of shilling for the movie at some of the openings, at some of the events. And then after that, working with another person, he wrote his own tale of the event, which he aptly called Center of the Storm.
Again, James Presley.
I think he was probably a little surprised, and I was pleased at the attention he got when the book came out, because it had been so long ago. Wherever he went, there was attention because the people remembered enough of the Scopes trial. They knew it was a big thing, even if they were too young to remember it. In a way, it was just like the Sphinx had finally spoken.
And the Sphinx would keep speaking. This time, he spoke his mind, even voicing support for teachers in Tennessee and Arkansas who challenged laws barring them from teaching evolution. And as we wrapped our conversation in the historic Dayton courtroom, Ed Larson told me about the only time he ever saw John Scopes.
I remember my father calling me down. I was already in bed, and telling me that John Scopes was going to be on the Johnny Carson show. And so I remember going down, and Carson had a wonderful way with guests. But you could tell that he had a certain awe and respect for John Scopes. It was a very interesting interview that he could take a person like Johnny Carson, who could easily turn it into a joke about Monkeyville, and made it into an interview where he spoke with deep respect, as if he was talking to a hero of American freedom.
Eventually, a life well-lived caught up with John. As the 1960s waned, his health went with it, the pain confining him to his bed by the middle of 1970. And on October 21st, 1970, John Thomas Scopes quietly passed away. A funeral was held at St. John Birchman's in Shreveport, before Mildred brought him home to Paducah to rest beside his parents. The controversy that followed John Scopes throughout his life has never gone away. His 21st century legacy when I Am John Scopes returns. I'm Todd Hatton, and this is I Am John Scopes. So if John Scopes hadn't taken the job in Dayton, if he'd said no to Fred Robinson, there would have been no trial, and possibly the culture clash over evolution would look a lot different today. But when John stepped back from it all, both for himself and to get out of the way of the issues, did he do his job too well? Have we forgotten the Scopes in the Scopes trial? Dr. Jerry Coyne is a professor and scientist at Scopes' graduate alma mater, the University of Chicago, and he's the author of Why Evolution is True. I asked him if he thought Scopes and the trial named for him has influenced a dispute that's still unsettled.
That was the beginning of formalized opposition to creationism in America. I mean, Scopes lost his case, on a technicality. The judge levied the fine instead of the jury. But so the law, the Butler Act, was not overturned. But that was the beginning of legal challenges to creationism in America. So he was a forerunner. I mean, but it's also shown that it hasn't worked. It just keeps coming back, you know, like those little rubber clowns. I don't know if they have them for kids anymore, but you'd punch them and they'd come back up again. That's what creationism is in America. If you punch it, biblical creationism down, it comes back up as scientific creationism, Epperson versus Arkansas. You punch that down, comes back as intelligent design. Punch that down, as they did in the Dover trial, it comes back as, well, let's just teach the problems with evolution, which is what's going on now in lots of states.
But not so much in other Western countries. Murray State Science professor Dr. David Canning is, as they say, not from around here, and he says that in the United Kingdom, there really isn't any contention between evolution and creationism. Darwin's even on the 10-pound note. But does he think there's a legacy for John Scopes?
Oh, absolutely. One of the things that I do to try and understand my students is try and understand those students who perhaps would have some objection to the concept of evolution. I pay attention to the intelligent design movement and this type of thing. And the intelligent design movement really can be traced right back to the reaction to the Scopes trial, because it ridiculed the anti-evolutionists from trying to attack evolution from religious ideas directly. And so it kind of forced them underground, the fundamentalists. And it wasn't until the 1960s or so they started to come up with an alternative strategy, which is the sort of like wedge strategy, which is to attack evolution from a pseudoscientific type approach, and, you know, try and take the obvious religion out of the argument and try and come up with some kind of other argument where the null hypothesis, if you like, is a designer.
The null hypothesis is something or some idea to be tested with the understanding that it's true. And the strategy Canning refers to is in a 1999 Discovery Institute plan called the Wedge Document. In a nutshell, it starts with publications criticizing so-called Darwinism, then more writing and publishing, then publicity and opinion making, and lastly, cultural confrontation. In other words, creating the very controversy they want taught. The document sets out goals for making intelligent design an accepted alternative to evolution, getting their academics into universities, their ideas into the natural sciences, the humanities, and fine arts. One of their 5-year objectives was getting design theory featured on a, quote, PBS show such as Nova, end quote. In 2007, the Discovery Institute got its wish, but not in the way they may have wanted.
Up next on Nova, Judgment Day. Intelligent design on trial.
The program covers the 2005 Kitzmiller v. Dover Board of Education case. School board members tried to get intelligent design into Dover, Pennsylvania science classes and lost. 10 minutes in, the show makes the reference that's almost required in the subject.
Their legal battles stretch back to the famous Scopes Monkey Trial of 1925.
I hereby place you under arrest.
Later on, the program notes the trial had a chilling effect on the teaching of evolution in schools, one that lasted until the 1960s, about the time Scopes and Presley published Center of the Storm, which may not be a coincidence. But what's it like today?
My name is Mike Chipman, and I am a teacher at Murray High School. I teach biology.
So when Chipman was in high school, was evolution covered?
Growing up, it wasn't at all. I had no basis at all in that. So when I went and had classes here at Murray State, were my first exposure to evolutionary science. I had just grabbed a hold of the ideas that I'd been taught growing up, you know, men come from monkeys and all these other things. And so it was actually being taught well here that I learned what the true science behind evolution was.
And he says teaching that science to his students can be a challenge.
A lot of the challenge exists with people's preconceived notions concerning evolution. And so a lot of times what I have to do is cut through some of that. And I think the biggest thing is that people think that in order to study it, they have to then give up their beliefs. And that's not the case at all. You can study something and not agree with it. You know, even as a science teacher, I try to get students to learn that, which is not just a science skill, but it's also a skill that takes you other places in life as well. It's okay to disagree with something yet still appreciate it.
That's something Chipman can say with some authority. He not only knows a lot about science, he knows a thing or two about belief.
I'm actually a pastor locally here, and I don't see a disconnect between teaching students this is the scientific view of evolution and my own personal beliefs, which don't even come into my classroom at all. Now, students are allowed to ask questions concerning that, and I usually say, let's talk after class. That is beyond the scope of what I'm required to teach you in this classroom. I don't want to mix the two because frankly, that they need to learn, this is science, this is biology, this is what you need to learn, this is what I'm required to teach you, and I'm going to do that, and I want to do that well.
There are those who think that scientists and educators like Coyne, Canning, and Chipman are too limited and limiting on what they teach in class. They consider themselves skeptics about evolution. And not unlike the defendants in the Dover, Pennsylvania case, they think competing ideas should be heard in the science curriculum. And what are their competing ideas? Ryan Brooks is lead missionary for Christ Ambassadors at Murray State University. He and Chipman seem to agree that religion and science can coexist. But Brooks also says he hasn't seen anything to convince him that evolution happens outside of what we can see.
I think that we can show, using good science, that within a species there are mutations that occur, and over a long period of time, that species evolves. And I don't have any problem believing that. I don't have any problem lining that up with what I know about what the Bible says, Old Testament and New. So I would call that everyday evolution because I think that we can see that with our eyes. I think that science at this point has proven that that only happens within a species. And outside of that species, it doesn't jump to another species. And that's my biggest hang up at this point with believing an evolutionary point of view. No one has ever shown me, and I've never read anything that would show me any good evidence that evolution happens between species.
It's important to note that Brooks's perspective isn't the only Christian one. There's a broad range among the different denominations. Catholics, Anglicans, and many other mainline Protestant denominations have no trouble at all with evolution. But there are others who do, and they take issue with the way intelligent design is, or rather is not, portrayed in the classroom. Again, Ryan Brooks.
I have a journalism degree, and I am not scared of both sides of the story being told, even in the classroom. I think that if we lived in a culture of do your homework, and we lived in a culture of you better check your facts, then it would not be nearly as dangerous to paint a one-sided picture in the classroom.
But Canning says there is only one side.
There's absolute scientific consensus 100% on the fact that evolution occurred. You're not going to find any scientist who's going to reject that. If they do, then they're not really a scientist.
And as for John Scopes?
Boy, I wish we could turn back the clock, because I think he probably would have made different decisions knowing the outcome. In my own research, it seems to me like he took the limelight for a little while and then scurried away as quickly as he could. And I think he just got wrapped up in a giant play by the ACLU to challenge a law. And if the law was that evolution shouldn't be taught, and the textbook that he was forced to teach out of for 2 weeks included evolution, then the law needed to be changed. I think he didn't believe strongly enough either way to really stake his